This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, sitting in for Neal Conan. Last month, pictures of an isolated tribe in a remote area of the Amazon revealed an astonishing scene. Indigenous men painted with red dye, aiming bows and arrows at an airplane. The photos were taken during a flight conducted by the Brazilian government's Indian Affairs Department, known by the acronym FUNAI. Scientists know very little about this tribe and others that live along the border of Peru and Brazil. The tribes live in dense jungle areas, the most impenetrable regions of the Amazon. The people are the last uncontacted tribes of the Americas. Today, we talk to a writer who's trekked into the Amazon to learn more about the so-called uncontacted tribes. And we want to hear from you. What are your questions about these people? And what's your opinion? How far should we go to make sure these tribes remain uncontacted? Give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. The email address, talk@npr.org. And you can also comment on our blog. It's at npr.org/blogofthenation. A bit later in the show, we talk with the maker of a new documentary, Football Undercover. It tells the story of a match between a women's soccer team in Germany and a women's team in Iran. But first, uncontacted tribes. Joining us right now is Scott Wallace. He's a writer for National Geographic, and he joins me here in Studio 3A. So good to have you with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's talk first about this photo. Why were they taken, and what was so remarkable about them?
Well, this was done actually as part of a routine reconnoitering of that jungle area by FUNAI, which is the Brazilian Indian Affairs Agency. FUNAI is a particular department within FUNAI, the Department of Isolated Indians, is actually charged with monitoring in a remote fashion the relative health and well-being of a certain number of uncontacted tribes that have been identified in Brazil. And one of the ways they do that is by aerial surveillance. So normally these planes will fly over villages that are known to exist at a, you know, reasonably high altitude so as not to provoke or to frighten the Indians. But in this particular case, there has been pressure building. Peru next door has made official declarations doubting the existence of these people and the various tribes that are down there. I think what happened was these Brazilian officials decided that they were going to show the world that these tribes actually do exist. So they flew down at a very obviously low altitude, low enough to frighten the Indians and provoke them into the posture they took, pointing their bows and arrows at the plane.
What's at stake here between Peru and Brazil that there would be this difference of opinion over whether these tribes exist in the first place?
Well, Brazil has a much more elaborate, first of all, policy and institutional infrastructure for dealing with this type of situation. It's been known in Brazil for years. Brazil has had uncontacted tribes. Basically the story of the Amazon, the history of the Amazon is a history of contact with so-called wild Indians, uncontacted groups. And Brazil has evolved a policy specific to the treatment of these Indians. So, but on the Peruvian side, there hasn't been that kind of, there isn't that kind of history, and it's much more kind of free-for-all. And in recent times in Peru, the government has auctioned off huge tracts of the Amazon for oil exploration, including in lands that where these uncontacted groups are known to exist. And they've also been pretty lax about letting loggers into these areas, and they're putting these tribes at risk.
Okay.
But the Brazilians have been much more, you know, advanced in terms of their policy.
Let me ask you about that phrase, uncontacted tribes, because are they really completely uncontacted? I mean, you yourself went into the rainforest looking for these people and got pretty close, although you deliberately didn't contact them. But let's talk first about that phrase. What does that mean, uncontacted? Have they really not been contacted?
Well, you know, it's interesting. It depends on – there are different situations depending on the groups. There are probably somewhere perhaps around 60 or 70 uncontacted groups in the Amazon. The majority of them are in Brazil. But Peru harbors probably about 15 of these groups. And the level of contact or exposure to outside society depends on which group you're talking about. In some instances, there's probably been very little or absolutely no contact with the outside world. In others, maybe a member of the tribe has ventured out and come back or something like that. But in any instance, in all instances, what is believed to be the case is that these Indians are the descendants of survivors of violent, bloody contact with the outside world that may have dated back to the 18th or 19th or early 20th century. Their forebears vanished into the deepest redoubts of the Amazon to avoid, to survive. And these are the successive generations.
Let's talk about that trip that you took. You went with a man named Sidney Pozuelos, if I'm
correct,
pronouncing that correctly. Tell us a little about him and what he does.
Sidney Pozuelos is an extraordinary person. He is a lifelong, what in Brazil is called a sertanista. A sertanista is like an Amazonian scout. And they are Indian rights activists, adventurers, ethnographers, wilderness scouts. And Pozuelo has followed in this tradition that's been evolving in Brazil for a couple of centuries. He pioneered within FUNAI this department of isolated Indians specifically to treat and take care of uncontacted Indians. Prior to Pozuelo assuming the reins of this department, the policy was generally FUNAI's job, one of its jobs, was to go into the deep jungle in advance of the frontier, in advance of, say, the Trans-Amazonian Highway or right. whatever, the agricultural frontier. And these scouts, these woodsmen would go in advance of that to make contact with, you know, uncontacted groups in order to soften the blow, maybe even move them to a new location, soften the blow of that contact with civilization. But Pozuelo developed this new policy that if we can identify where these groups are and who they are, let's protect their land and erect a barricade around it, basically, and let them live without contact.
Yeah, it was interesting because I think you mentioned in the course of the article that at one time when he first started, the way you made your name was to rack up as many tribes as possible that you had contacted. He had contacted something like seven tribes and made contact with these people. And then he backed off and said, something's going wrong with this. Why? What did he see? What did he witness when he contacted those tribes? What happened?
Right. It would be a status thing among these groups to make as many first contacts as possible, you know. But what Pozuelo found was inevitably that no matter how humanitarian the contact was, you know, how the terms of contact were made, that the Indians would inevitably succumb to epidemic disease because these are basically virgin soil populations. Those Indians that were photographed last month, or those photos released last month, they've not had contact with the outside. So, you know, one of the definitions maybe you could make for uncontacted tribes, they do not have immunity to our common germs, influenza, measles, cold. So, you know, within weeks of first contact, their populations can be decimated by these diseases. And so Pozuelo saw rampant disease, the Indians, once vibrant warriors, reduced to dislocated caricatures of a drunken, idle, broken beggar.
Okay.
And he decided that the best thing to do would be to leave these people alone, if at all possible.
We're talking with Scott Wallace. He's a writer for National Geographic magazine. We're discussing uncontacted tribes in the Amazon along the border of Peru and Brazil. If you'd like to give us a call, the number is 800-989-8255. The email address is talk at npr.org. And we're going to go to Karen now, who is calling from Culver, Oregon. Hi, Karen.
Oh, yes, ma'am. Thank you for having me on. I was wanting to know, what is the actual name of this tribe, and how do they actually know that they have never been contacted by any of the, you know, the not the other Aborigines, but the other so-called, you know, sort of half and half people that live in their area.
And you're asking about the name of the tribe in the photograph, because I don't want to mix things up, because Scott also...
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Thanks very much for your call, Scott.
Well, I think the same situation pertains to this group that's down beneath the airplane, as well as the group whose lands we crossed through in the expedition for that I was on for National Geographic. Nobody really knows what these Indians call themselves. This particular group has been identified by FUNAI as the isolated of the headwaters of the Rio Invira, the Invira River. In the case of the group whose lands we crossed, and it took us to get to these places, I mean, you're talking about deep, deep, deep jungle. So to get to the area where the group that, we were in close proximity to required 2.5 weeks on the river and then 3 weeks of daily slashing through virgin jungle to get into their homeland. And they were obviously very concerned and scared.
3 weeks with no trail, you're saying?
That's correct. That's correct. Just to get in.
Wow.
And then to get out was a whole nother matter. But in that case, those Indians, people, they were called, they are called, people regionally refer to them as Os Flecheiros, the people of the arrow people, because nothing really was known about them except that they use arrows to repel, poison-tipped arrows to repel any and all intruders. But since there's never been peaceful contact with them, nobody knows what they call themselves.
Yeah. And we should just to address the second part of Karen's question, I think, Karen, are you still there? I think Karen is gone, but I think that she was asking about whether I guess she was saying something about the fact that there are some people who may have had some contact, their tribes who there have been some contact with versus those who haven't had any contact.
It's hard to know if maybe there are in the areas adjacent to where these uncontacted tribes are known to wander, there have been. There's sightings, people maybe shouting to each other back and forth or making hand signals or so forth. But generally speaking, the contact is very sporadic. The contacted Indians fear these groups.
So. All right. Scott, hold on to that thought. We're going to continue this discussion when we return from a short break. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. We're talking today about the lives of isolated tribes in the rainforests of Latin America. Our guest is Scott Wallace, a writer for National Geographic magazine. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And you can also comment on our blog. It's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Scott, before we take another call, I just wanted to explain a little bit more about the expedition that you were part of, because I don't know if we've made it clear what happened. You got very close to where these people were, but deliberately didn't make contact. Maybe you can tell us what happened as you got very close to their territory.
Yeah. Well, Pozuelo led this expedition, the man we were talking about before. One of the things that he does and the Brazilian government does is occasionally they will mount expeditions into the lands of some of these groups, not to make contact with them, but to basically check on their relative well-being, to see if there's any imminent danger of infiltration from poachers or loggers or other intruders. And you can't, this is closed canopy jungle, so you can't do that just by aerial surveillance. You actually have to go in on the ground. And when you do go on the ground, when you go in, you have to have a large enough contingent to for security reasons, and it's a dangerous place. We went in there, and as you move through the forest, and this is primeval, incredible. This is an incredible place. It almost feels like walking on the bottom of the ocean with this diffused light way up overhead, and you're moving through this like incredible gloom past trees that are like enormous columns. And as you move deeper into this forest, you begin to find signs of these people lying around. Anybody who moves in the jungle will snap off twigs as they go around at about hand level as they're walking to mark their so they can find their way back from, you know, when they're walking in the woods. And you start seeing these little snapped off twigs. And the guys that we're with, I was with 35 men and 20 Indians from three different tribes in that area. They're fantastic wilderness scouts and trackers, and they can see one of these signs like a snap twig and instantly say, this happened, this was from 2 months ago. We came upon a fishing camp, like basically these little primitive huts that were like the size, the height of like maybe what you would guess a hobbit might live in. And these were their shelters, and they would look at this and they'd say, oh, this was from last summer. You know, this was from a year ago. And as we went deeper and deeper in, these vestiges were like became, you know, closer and closer in time to us, which also implied they were actually closer to us, you know, in terms of distance.
Didn't you actually see footprints at a certain
point? And we not only did we see footprints, but one of our scouts says, oh, my God, this is from like right now. And so we knew that they had sighted us.
Yeah.
And that these couple of these Indians had seen us and they took off running. And so then we knew that they knew that we were there.
All right. Let's take a call now. We're going to go to Jim. And Jim is calling from Willow Grove, Pennsylvania. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
Thank you. I have a question. It sounds like the Brazilian government protects these people from human encroachment, but I wonder what their policy is relative to pending natural disasters, like, you know, if a fire were threatening the area or some kind of major flood, would they swoop in to intervene, or is it a hands-off policy as far as nature goes?
Interesting question. I think in the case of a flood, they would probably let that go because the Amazon, you know, routinely floods and water levels can fluctuate up to like 60 feet from dry season to the rainy season. So, which is not to say that floods aren't dangerous even for these people, but I think in that case they would let it go. In the case of a out of control wildfire, that's a really interesting question. I suppose I would not really pretend to be able to answer, you know, or make Brazilian government policy here on the air. But I think there would probably be those in the Brazilian government who would make the case that they needed to go in and do something about it.
All right. Thanks so much for your call, Jim. And we're going to bring on another guest now who might also be able to respond to that question. Jonathan Mazower is a campaign coordinator for Survival International, an organization to protect Indigenous rights. And he joins us from his home in Oxfordshire, England. Thanks so much for being with us, Mr. Mazower.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I guess my first question was going to be, what are governments doing to protect these tribes? And I don't know if you heard that last caller who was asking specifically about whether governments do anything to protect them during a natural disaster, fire, for instance.
The long and the short of it is that there are a lot of conflicting views within the Brazilian government and kind of conflicting political forces at play. So the photos of the uncontacted Indians that, you know, made headlines a couple of weeks ago were taken by a department of the Brazilian government that is entrusted with protecting these very isolated groups, and they are mostly run by very committed individuals who are doing their best to monitor a very large, very remote area and ensure that no outsiders go in there if there are thought to be uncontacted or isolated Indians living there. But of course, there are a lot of other very powerful players in Brazilian society, and the cattle ranching business and the agricultural sector are extremely well-financed and influential, and there is a very concerted lobbying effort going on right now for a lot of the reserves that the Brazilian government has created to protect the Indian population to be opened up.
What about the Peruvian government? Do they have a completely different attitude?
Well, it's funny because in the one sense they are more progressive because Peru has recognized for many years the rights of the tribal peoples there to actually own their lands. So that is to say that they get the physical title to their lands and no one can take that away from them. In Brazil, by contrast, Indians cannot own any land at all, and legally speaking they're actually treated as children. They are deemed not to be able to... they don't have the kind of legal status of adults. And so because they are not allowed to own any land and the Indian territories are merely set aside by the government, they are much more vulnerable to the borders of those territories being changed after lobbying. Whereas in Peru, the Indian communities can own their land, but there are very severe problems of enforcement. And the big problem in the Peruvian Amazon right now, in this area where these isolated Indians are living, is there's a massive wave of illegal logging, illegal mahogany logging, that is sending hundreds of loggers into these very isolated areas, which are really the last places in the Amazon where mahogany is growing in any kind of quantity. And those people are coming, those loggers are coming into contact with these very isolated Indian groups.
All right, we're going to take a call now from Nick. He's calling from Detroit. Hi, Nick.
Good afternoon.
Go ahead.
Right now I'm taking a course on ancient cities and lost civilizations, and I realized that there might be a scientific value in studying the human behavior of these people and just looking at their maybe burial rituals, religious rituals, anything like that. And I was just wondering, is there any scientific value to observing these people as unobtrusively as possible? Maybe we can learn something from them.
Jonathan Mazower first.
Well, the problem with the people whose photos we saw a couple of weeks ago, of course, is that any outsider who tries to enter their territory is likely to get a very hostile reception. And that isn't due to any kind of irrationality or superstition or anything like that. It's because perhaps 100, 150 years ago, the rubber boom swept through that whole Western Amazon region when European companies were set up to look for rubber, and it devastated the Indian tribes who were living there. Most estimates say around 90% of the Indians were wiped out, and so the survivors retreated into these very remote headwaters, and it's their descendants who are the kind of people who were in the photos. So the only way such societies can be studied is by the air, and that in itself is going to be very intrusive to them and going to disturb them greatly. But I would say that there are, you know, a large number of very thriving Indian groups throughout Amazonia, in really all the countries of the Amazon. Many of them have been very well studied by anthropologists and others, and so I wouldn't say that there is anything particularly unusual about these uncontacted Indians, other than the fact that they have managed to retreat into the remotest parts of the Amazon and stay there, and have managed to so far kind of repel outsiders, although they have often suffered massacres themselves. But they are almost certainly living in a very similar way to neighboring tribes, of whom quite a lot is known, and there are people who speak their languages and who have lived and worked with them for decades. So in general, Amazonian Indian societies are very well known and understood, I think I would agree with your call in that I think we have a lot to learn from them, and most of us, our natural reaction when faced with these kinds of societies who in one way seem so different to ours, there's a natural fascination and a natural interest to learn more about them.
Right. But Jonathan, before I let you go, your position would be that these tribes should be left alone, and that there should be really a kind of coordinated effort to to do that, I think. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not just because they have suffered atrocities and violence in the past, but because, as is well known now, they are extremely vulnerable to the common cold, to influenza, to these common Western diseases that for you and I might be inconvenient but are hardly likely to be fatal. And for isolated Amazonian societies who have no immunity, no antibodies to these kinds of diseases, they can be absolutely devastating. So we would say for their own sake they should be left alone. They have the right to be left alone. And as long as their territory is protected, then, you know, leave them be and let them make their own choices about when and how they interact with the outside world. Let that be up to them.
All right. Thanks so much for joining us, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Jonathan Mazower is the campaign coordinator for Survival International, an organization that supports tribal people, and he joined us from his home in England. And you are listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Scott Wallace is still here with me. He's a writer for National Geographic magazine, and we're going to take another call from Hadra, and she's calling from, or he's calling from Chicago.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Thanks.
I don't know the level of contact that was reached with these tribes, but has there been any attempt to discern their language or to discern what level of sophistication their language has been reached, as has been done with some of the last uncontacted tribes of Papua New Guinea?
Well, you know, it depends on which group you're talking about, because there are areas in the Amazon where it is known that, you know, certain isolated groups are actually part of a tribe that separated and went their separate ways earlier on. For example, in Ecuador, one of the uncontacted groups in Ecuador is actually a splinter group of the Huarani. They made contact, they accepted contact and were basically brought into, you know, Ecuadorian society by the outside world by American missionaries in many instances, and their part of their tribe decided that they did not want that kind of exposure to the outside world, and they retreated into the deeper jungle. So, in some instances, it's well known what the languages are that they speak, and the same is true in Peru. Some of the isolated groups are actually splinter groups of other tribes who have had contact with the outside. But in some instances, it's not known at all what language they speak or what they call themselves, or, you know, those kinds of details are unknown and remain a mystery. And Sidney Pozuelo, who took us into that area, whom I accompanied into that area, says, you know, I don't need to know those things. I don't really care what language they speak or what gods they worship or what ethnic group they belong to. I don't need to know that information in order to protect them.
All right. Thanks so much for your call. We're going to take a call now from John. John's calling from Austin, Texas. Hi, John.
Hi. I just had a question. How do you respond to the question of why haven't these tribes technologically evolved? I mean, they're basically, you know, at least 1,000 or more years behind almost all the rest of the world. And how would you respond to that question? And why don't they evolve? Are they?
That's a great question, and I think to actually view. To presume that we understand what their level of evolvement or evolution is, I think, is a little bit of a conceit. After all, these people are perfectly adapted to the rainforest. They understand how to live in one of the most inhospitable environments in the world. They have evolved agriculture. They have tools. They have weapons. They know how to function in that environment. And in fact, the West, we who are so technologically advanced, we Westerners still do not know how to develop the Amazon without destroying it. Mm-hmm. And these people have lived in there for thousands of years, basically in harmony with the environment. So, you know, that's just one little, you know, way of looking at that question. But also, I think it's really interesting to note that, you know, they don't have a lot of the things that we have, and perhaps it's because they didn't have the domesticated animals. They lived in a harsh environment, so they haven't been able to accumulate large surpluses and wealth and the kinds of things that are basically the underpinnings of big civilizations, where you generate a surplus and the wealth that's required for a division of labor and all the things that you can accomplish in that kind of complicated civilization. So anyway, fantastic question. Thanks for the call.
Scott, we're almost out of time, but do you think it's realistic to think these tribes can be left alone, that they won't be contacted?
I think that we can do what we can to try to keep it from happening. I think, you know, as Jonathan was saying from England, that it's very important that we try to protect these people as much as possible and keep people out of there and let these people decide when they want to make contact with the outside world.
Thanks so much for joining us today. Scott Wallace is a writer for National Geographic magazine. Stay tuned. We'll be talking with a filmmaker about the film Football Undercover, about an Iranian women's soccer team. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Lynn Neary.